Hello, and welcome along to the Colchester Arts Centre's Never Knowingly Understood podcast. My name is Tim Morgan, and this episode is entitled Revolution Songs, and we'll be catching up with two artists that will be performing here within the next few months. First up is Steve Ignorant, who will be here on October the 5th performing Crass songs for the first time at Colchester Arts Centre. And also, a little later on, I'll be catching up with Corinne Paulwart, who will be here on Tuesday the 13th of June performing a solo acoustic set, and one not to be missed. Now, I was recently very, very lucky to catch up with Steve Ignorant, formerly of Crass, who will be here on October the 5th. Steve has previously played here with his other band, which is Slice of Life. I think he's been here three times, but he's going to be able to tell you all about that. So let's hand you over to Steve, and I hope you enjoy this interview.
If I can ask you then, Steve, so you're at the Colchester Arts Centre in October, October the 5th.
Yes.
Now, you've been to the Arts Centre a few times already, haven't you?
Yeah, three times, yeah.
And that was with Slice of Life?
Yeah.
And so is this the first time you're going to be performing Crass songs?
Absolutely, yeah, at the Colchester Arts Centre, yeah. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Great venue, isn't it?
It's really good, you know, it's, yeah, really good. Yeah, I really like it there. That's why I've been back so many times. You know, I just find the people there are, they're some of the nicest people, the loveliest people you could ever wish to work with or, you know, meet. You know, the sound is great. And the venue itself is just wonderful. You know, it's just, you know, what's not to love about it, you know. And it's, you know, the fact that a lot of people volunteer to work there is brilliant. You know, I've become friends with some of the bars. Dave, you know, who works behind the bar sometimes. We've become great friends. So, you know, I just really like it.
Excellent stuff. And so the first time out there performing Crass songs, which is going to be an event, I think. I saw you, I think it was last year at the 100 Club when you played.
Yeah.
And it's the same lineup that we'll be playing?
Yeah, same lineup. Yeah. Yeah, same lineup. But it's, we've incorporated a few more of the female songs. So Carol's doing a bit more, which is nice. And the set is sort of a lot more, it's different. You know, it's not just like run of the mill hit.
Yeah.
It's like we've got some quirky bits in there as well. We're really enjoying it. Very exciting.
Excellent. Are you sort of in the midst of touring at the moment, or have you kind of got some time off?
No, I've got some time off, which is you know quite good really, because it gives me time. It's given me time to pop into the studio now and again and work on some Slice of Life stuff. Because the thing with doing this Crass thing is that it can overtake everything you're doing.
Yeah.
And so that's really good, and it just gives me time to rejuvenate. You know, at the age of 65, I need a bit of a rest now and again. So. Yeah, but think of Charlie Harper, Steve. I think of him all the time. So well, bless his cotton socks.
Well, I think Charlie Harper is is he saying he's going to retire at the end of this year?
I heard something about that. You know, I heard something, but I'm pretty sure, you know, he'll keep doing something or other. You know, he'll pop up now and again. You know.
So, and you said about Slice of Life and going back into the studio.
Yeah.
So is there going to be, so have you had, you've had two studio and one live album so far?
Yeah, what happened was that I was going to go, you know, I was concentrating on new Slice of Life stuff, but then this, we started rehearsing for the Crass thing. This is way back in 2020.
Yeah.
And then we got hit by the pandemic, so that threw everything apart. And then I totally lost momentum. And that was one of the big worries about COVID thing was that I think all of us individually in the band were like, oh, you know, when are we going to be able to do it again? I think people have forgotten this a lot. You know, it's like, well, when, you know, there was no time span for it. Mm-hmm. You know, venues were closing down, losing money and all this. And it's like, oh my God, you know, there's going to be nowhere to play. This is going to be awful. And will we lose momentum? Will I feel whenever it comes? But, you know, do you know what? I don't want to do it anymore. You know, So it was all that kind of thing. So I found it really difficult to write lyrics or anything for Slice of Life, because everything that was coming out was about bloody COVID, you know. And I thought, well, I can't do that. Everyone's doing that, you know. It's boring. So you know, I just had to put everything on the back burner. But now all I'm doing in the studio now is I'm going down whatever I've got in my head, whether they're cheesy, stupid, you know, rubbishy bits of music, but I'm just going in there and I'm putting them down, and just seeing what comes out of it, you know. So just really experimenting for the first time, you know.
And so your kind of your love of music, at where did it? Because obviously Bowie's a big thing, but where did your kind of love of music start?
I think love of music, it started when I went to see a film called West Side Story at the cinema, and I remember crying even before the film started, just because of the beauty of the music. You know, there was just something in there that just absolutely moved me, and I didn't realise it at the time. You know, I thought I was crying because it's a sad story, and you know, da da da. But later on, I realised no, it wasn't that. It was just I was moved by the absolute marvelousness of that music. And then, you know, so then I didn't know who had composed it, but later on I found out it was Leonard Bernstein. And I found myself, when I was listening to the radio, that I was actually listening for stuff that was similar to West Side Story. Hence I then got into Burt Bacharach, because he uses a lot of strings and a lot of brass. And then of course David Bowie was now and again getting orchestral. And then I discovered Joni Mitchell, who was putting orchestration into her thing. So all the time I was seeking out this sort of similar kind of music to West Side Story. And I think that's where it comes from.
And do you think that's kind of more so? I mean, I guess with Slice of Life, it's pretty, I mean, it's poles apart from pretty much what you were doing with Crass, really. And do you think that kind of love of that sort of music's kind of informed what you're doing now, or was it just that you needed a break from
No, I think that subconsciously I knew what I was aiming for with Slice. I mean, it's sort of really, again, I didn't realise I was doing it, but I was listening to David Bowie when he was David Jones. You know, When I Live My Dream, and London Boys, and things like that, before he became big, you know. And I found myself, I was like, I'm like, you know, why I'm not plagiarizing him or whatever, you know, but it's just like similar. And with the sort of, I just do the music that I want to. I mean, I can I play a guitar? Ish, I can play open chords and an acoustic, that's it. So then I get these chords and I'll listen to something. I'm like, oh, that's an A minor, and then that's a D, and that's, oh, that's sort of similar. Of course, it's nothing like the song I've heard, but then I pass it over to Pete. Do something that Pete, and he comes all amazing. Same, can I play piano? No, I can plunk. And then I pass it over to Carol. But yeah, so that's why my songs that I wrote, that I write, are really, really simple. But to me, this is another thing. I listened to a composer called Eric Satie. Listeners might know it. It used to be on an advert on TV, you know, Gymnopédies thing. And all it is roughly is two chords all the way through. And apparently Eric Satie would sit there all night just playing two chords, and same two chords on the piano, driving everyone nuts. And I thought, well, if it works for him, who says it? Who says a song can't be two chords? So that's what I tend to work on. If I can fit another one in, that's a bonus. Yeah, if I can fit four in, that's an opus, you know. So you know, and I thought, well, you can still do it. You just have two chords. You can put a violin over the top of it, and it's, well, you know, again, film soundtracks. You know, when I was younger, and still do. You know, I'm sitting there watching a film, and suddenly I'm not watching the film. I'm listening to the soundtrack. So that's what I, you know, tend to do.
So how did you end up at Dial House? How did that all kind of and was Crass going to be a thing, or did that just kind of evolve, or?
No, just evolved. All it was, first of all, I went there when I was the 12 years old. My brother took me over there to visit, And I just loved the place so much that I started playing truant from school and used to go over there and sort of stay nights and things. And then I got, you know, left school, got a job, so I did go there for a while. And then I was living in Bristol when punk started in 1977, and I thought, well, I want some of this. And my idea was that I'd go back to Dagenham, where I sort of grew up, and meet my old drinking buddies, and we'd start a punk band. Well, of course, I went back to Dagenham, then all got girlfriends and got married and all this sort of thing, and had kids, and so that was out. And I thought, well, while I'm here, you know, I'll just go back to Bristol. Then that's the end of that. And I thought, well, while I'm here, I'll just pop over to Dale House and see my old friends. So I walked in, and it was Penny Rambo living there on his own, and he said, what are you up to? And I went, I'm thinking of starting a band, and he went, well, I'll play drums for you, and that's literally how it started. Now, we never dreamt that it would become the thing that it did. I think me and Penn's real honest idea of it was that we would play and just try and shock people that came to Dale House, you know, those middle class hippie types. And we didn't think it would go further than the Garden Gate. So that was the idea of it. But, you know, how little did I know? So.
And then, I mean, because obviously there was, as well as the music being incredibly powerful, there was all the artwork that supported it. And obviously it was a very political time as well. Was it just everything came together?
Everything came together at the same time. It was just one of those weird, never to be repeated, gathering of like-minded people. In some cases, not like-minded, it turned out later when the band had split. But, you know, Crass can't be repeated. And I think the reason for that is because none of us were musicians. So we weren't restricted by the rule book that says a song must be verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, chorus, end. So we were like, well, who says if the first verse can't be 25 lines? And who says the chorus has to be, it can't be 48? And who says it has to be in 4/4 or 3/4 time? We'll just make our own time up, which was a nightmare when you rehearse it in Penny and Pete, right, the bass, drums and bass arguing for, oh God, can we just do 1, 2, 3, 4 like the Clash do, please? That's my idea of a punk band, not this avant-garde thing. But you know, it just worked, you know. And I quite often people say to me, you know, Crass punk, and I'm like, well, what's Crass punk really in music style? You know, it's just Crass, it's just Crass, you know. It's yeah, I don't know.
It's kind of credited with starting the kind of what would be classed as a narco-punk, I suppose, because it was a little bit more, it felt more dangerous than some of the stuff that had gone before.
Yeah, well, you know, as far as I was concerned, I wasn't going to hold back. You know, I knew we were never going to get on an EMI or get a, we were offered, you know, but we were never going to be up there, you know, doing that. We'd always be on our own. And like, no, if I've got something to say, I'm going to say it. I'm going to say it in the most brazen, most down-to-earth way possible. And if you don't like it, you can do one, mate. And I think that's the way we all were. And that came out in the music as well. We weren't playing with it, you know. That to us was then. That was our life. We didn't stop at the weekend, you know. But it carried on, you know, all for 7 years. You know, it was just relentless, relentless, relentless. And quite a few people have said to me that the first time they played Feeding the 5,000, it actually scared them, you know, because it was so woof, you
I'm one
know.
of
And
them.
yeah, well, it's very strange because I was unfortunate enough to overhear someone playing Christ Reality Asylum, you know, single, a few months ago. I was like, I don't remember it being that frightening and horrible and sort of dark. And it's like, that's really creepy. And I was like, well, yeah. So yeah, it sort of snatches on you. But that's what we did. You know, we weren't playing. That was, you know, that's. You know, look, I've never sort of hated hippies or anything. I think what the hippie movement did was great. You know, they had their own health centers, their own lawyers, squat movement, et cetera, made people aware of their lives and everything. The trouble is that the fashion was a bit awful. And the difference between, you know, us and the hippies was that the hippies were saying, oh, we'd like a better world. please, if possible. And the difference with us is, well, we want a better world, and if we don't get it, you're going to get a kick in the head, mate.
And was the intention that it would always be 7 years and that
No.
It would finish?
No, it wasn't at all. That Penny Rambo's done interviews, and I've seen them and heard them, where he says, yeah, it was. That's why we had the countdown, 7, 2, 1, 9, 8, 4. I remember having a conversation with Penny. I went, like, this countdown, I think it got down to 5, 2, 1, 9, 8, 4. I mean, Penny, what happens when it gets to 1984 and we're still going? Do we do sort of minus or what? He went, oh, we'll worry about it when we get there. So it wasn't pre-ordained. It was just,
Okay.
It just happened on that final gig in Wales. Andy Palmer said he wouldn't leave the band, and that was it.
And there was a period where you kind of, I guess you left Crass aside after that. And then 2007, you did a couple of nights at Shepherd's Bush doing Feeding of the 5,000.
Yeah.
And what was the kind of motivation? Was that to draw a line, or was that to...
No, that was really bizarre, and that wasn't of my doing. I mean, it sounds like I'm sort of back in the world. What happened was, I just moved to Norfolk, right? And my idea was, right, no more music, that's no more bands, I've had enough of it.
Yeah.
All I'm going to do is maybe write a book and sweep leaves and cut the grass. That's all I want to do now. Living by the sea. And getting this phone call, this bloke, Steve, we're doing a festival at Rixton Academy. And, you know, wondered if you'd like to do something. I was like, oh, you know, I don't know, you know, how long do I get? He went, I'm about half hour. I went, who else is playing? He went, well, the damn blah, blah, the usuals, you know, conflict. I was like, right, I'll think about it and I'll call you back. Intending not to, right, that's it. So I went down the pub, and while I'm down the pub, there's two blokes. You are. I mean, yeah, I've just been offered a gig, but I ain't gonna do it. And he said, well, why not? And I said, well, because I so long since I've done it, I'm sound awful. And I went, well, your music is awful anyway, isn't it? Why don't you do it? Because you know what's gonna happen, Steve. You won't do it, and then you'll regret it. You'll be in there moaning. Because I was like, so anyway, I went back, and then two friends came over, and we had dinner together, and told them about it, and they said, well, why aren't you gonna do it? And I went, I just don't. It just ain't for me, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we allow Steve Ignott to do Us to Live In, and everyone jumps up and down, and then, you know, and that's it. And I said, the only way I'd do it is if I could do something that's never done before. And then suddenly I was like, ping, this light came on me head, and I thought, right, I know what I'll do. So my idea was to do Feeding of 5,000, the record, except without Reality Asylum, as it was, which had never been performed by Crass. And that lasts about half hour. So I thought, look, if I get half hour slot, I can go in there just unannounced, bang, blow everyone away with this amazing set that's never been heard, you know, for over 30 years. And that's it. And then I'll just get me money and go home. So I say this to the bloke who's putting the gig on. And I went, yeah, I'm blah, blah, thinking of doing this, feeding off anybody. And it went all quiet. And I went, you're all right. He went, yeah, yeah, I'll call you back, call you back. So I put the phone down. I thought, blimey, I've upset him. He didn't like that record or so. He calls back in an hour and he goes, right, it's all changed now, Steve. You're headlining two nights at Shepherd's Bush Empire and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, hold on. And that's literally how it started. I'm like, I'm not going to fill Shepherd's Bush for two nights. I did.
And did that cause a little bit of friction with Penny at the time?
A little bit, yeah. well, he called me and said, Steve, I don't want you to use any of my material. I was like, oh, God, that's after bloody set. I was like, right, okay, fair enough, Pen, yeah. So I'm like, what can I do? I thought, I'll just have to do it and let him sue me. You know, what else can I do? But anyway, by the time the gig came around, about 2 weeks before the gig, he actually phoned me out and went, oh, Steve, I was just being very hasty there. He said, no, go ahead and do it. You know, he said, I've got my sensible head on now. So that was all fine, you know. But there was other really vicious, nasty stuff on social media, and what I heard from other people, from people who thought I was destroying the myth and the legend of Crass. And I was like, well, that's what it's all about, isn't it? To destroy these myths and legends, you know.
Yes.
And there's one person in particular that I'm still waiting to meet up with, because that's going to be a very interesting time. So, yeah, it's still... It still rankles a little bit, and it's not because of what he said about me, but because of the way he said it and all the people that were involved in that, all the other bands, all the people that were playing, performing with me, had put so much effort and hard work into it, and to be dissed, you know, like that, by that, hurt. That really hurt, you know, almost like it had to go at my family.
And then, so 2010, Benny appeared with you on stage, didn't he? I mean, was that, did that kind of bring it kind of full circle?
Yeah, that was the intention, because the whole idea of doing that gig was that, because I was, you know, starting Slice of Life.
Yeah.
And I didn't want people to come to Slice of Life gigs expecting to hear Crass songs. So really, though, that gig I did at the next one at Shepherd's Bush in 2011 was meant to be the be-all and end-all, which is why me and my big mouth actually say on DVD, that's it, I'm never doing Crass songs again. Idiot. Oh. So that's why Pen and Neve came on stage. It was meant to bring it full circle. And to tell the truth, I think that's the last time we'll ever perform that, us living together, live on stage. So it was a good place to end it. You know, bring it full circle for me and Pen. You know, as it started, so we'll finish it, just in a bigger room.
Yeah. And I've got to ask you, going away from music, can I just ask you, will Punch and Judy ever reappear?
No, I've seriously thought about it. I did it for a good, blimey, a good 7 years or something like that.
Yeah,
there was going to be a thing down at the village here, and I can't remember what it was for. Steve, would you do Punch and Judy? And I was like, do you know what? So anyway, I got all the stuff out, and it was just falling apart. I mean, the characters that I use are made out of paper mache, and I made them in 1989 or something like that. So they're so fragile. I just haven't got the patience to sit down and do it all again, you know. And plus, what put me off of doing Punch and Judy is the PC Brigade. Yeah, it just make me angry, you know. But you can't show the hanging scene. What, you think kids are going to go and play hanging in the kitchen, you know? But they're watching their video games where they're blowing each other's heads off with ray guns. What?
And that was Steve Ignorant, who is, if you haven't got your ticket yet, then I suggest you get one straight away, because this kind of opportunity doesn't happen very often. If you miss it, you'll only regret it.
Now coming up is our regular feature, in which Mick, the resident Arts Centre hippie, tells us about the forthcoming events that will be coming up.
Mick's picks are like a celestial flying teapot ride around a patchouli-scented galaxy, guaranteed to bring wonder and open the doors of perception.
Well, Mick's picks for June. This one's not for June. This one's for the 1st of July, because it's Mickfest, and that means me. What do we got? It's at the moment, it's half one doors. It runs until 11 p.m, but I'm trying to pull the doors forward to one so we can fit another act in. Headline is the Utopia Strong, featuring, who's it feature? Superstars everywhere you look, millions of them. Support from Elf Traps, support also from Massal, Kev Pierce, local singer-songwriter, is doing his stuff. Val Hallens, that's my band, by the way, so be there early or you'll miss us. Pete, what's his name? Pete's on. Pete's doing Mr. Tinkler and F Lithium. Leech Book are doing their thing. Think, I don't know, Witch Folk possibly? Who knows? What the hell? It's a day full of, well, wonder and insanity, and it's a mere 15 quid. Come along.
And next up is an interview that I recently did with Careen Paulwart. Now, Careen is a multi-award winning Scottish songwriter, folk singer and storyteller. And it's going to be a fabulous night. So I hope you enjoy the interview. And once you've heard it, then I would recommend that you rush off and buy a ticket.
If I can ask you then, so you're playing the Culture Strat Centre on Tuesday, June the 13th. Have you been there many times before?
I don't think I have ever played the Colchester Arts Centre. I could be wrong about that, but I think this might be my first time.
Okay. And you're out on a solo tour.
So... I am, yeah. Just of English venues, and then I get to Cardiff as well, right at the very end. But yeah, looking forward to it.
Is it a different kind of thing playing solo as opposed, you know, opposed to playing with bands?
It is quite different. I mean, I'm very lucky. I've got several different lineups that I play with. So I've been touring with my brother and my friend Inga Thompson as a trio for many, many years. I tour with a friend and neighbour, Dave Milligan, who's a pianist in a duo combination. Mm-hmm. I'm involved in bigger bands like Spell Songs. That's a seven-piece band with folks like Sekou Keita and Julie Fowlis and Chris Drever. So, you know, I'm really lucky that I get to play with lots of different lineups. But I guess touring solo, there's a kind of intimacy about that when there's just you on the road. I tell a lot of stories, like a lot of my gigs are, you know, the songs are mm-hmm. are always accompanied by stories. That's as much a part of the kind of performance as the music is as well. So I can talk for Scotland. And I've got no one to interrupt me when I'm on my own. And there is also just that if I was really completely blunt about it, there's a practicality about touring on my own. You know, it's been a difficult few years for musicians in terms of work. And I'm my own boss. So when I go on the road with other musicians, you know, I'm an employer and I'm responsible for paying people fair wages and I cover all the expenses. So there's a kind of practical brass tacks aspect to it all, but I hope it's also an enjoyable experience.
And do the songs come out differently when you're performing them as a, you know, as a solo?
Oh, they do. I mean, and actually, it's a different repertoire that I would take on the road by myself than I would if I was touring, for example, with my brother and Inga in the trio format. I guess there's a. I mean, a lot of the songs, I'll sing the songs that I've started as a kernel with just me and my guitars. I go out on the road with a guitar and tenor guitar. So they have to be songs that are just, that when you strip them down to their bare bones, they work in that kind of setting. And there are songs, I mean, also, you know, when I started as a musician 25 years ago, I was much more of a traditional style singer, so I sang unaccompanied a lot. So it gave me an opportunity to bring out songs that don't require any accompaniment at all. It's a slightly different set of songs. And also, to be blunt, there are some songs in my repertoire I play with my brother that I can't play.
Okay.
Like they're based on guitar parts, or in fact, they're written for piano. I wouldn't be playing the piano myself on tour. So it won't just be the same songs without all the nice layers that you would get with a band. It's a slightly different set of songs and it allows me to set them up in a different way and create something that's maybe a little bit more like the atmosphere of sitting by a fire or something like that. So it's a little bit more cosy and conversational perhaps than it would be in a band setting.
And the stories, you said about telling the stories, is that to set the song up or do you give background or do you let people kind of interpret the songs in their own way?
It's a combination of things. I mean, there are some songs that are inspired by particular stories. Mm-hmm. And the songs aren't a repeat of the stories. There's no point in telling a story and then telling the same story again. In your song. But I've realised as I've gone on over the years, especially over the last decade, that the aspect of it's no longer just a little bit of incidental chat between songs. It's really substantive kind of information about what's motivated something or the place something's been born from. And I've become, I think I would probably call myself a storyteller now as much as I would call myself a musician. And I've written some of those stories are stories of my experience. So some of them are old stories, you know, they're old folk tales that have helped to inspire some of the songs. So, yeah, it's a big part of what I do is the kind of conversational tone of things and setting the scene. And that's just my style. And it's a very common style amongst folk musicians to talk a lot.
Of course. Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, I mean, that's the whole thing. It is all about storytelling. But has that has that changed, do you think, since kind of post lockdown? Is it has there been a different kind of engagement or a wanting to engage more with audiences?
Yeah, I think what I realised when lockdown hit was that actually that trajectory for me of telling stories was really, really helpful during the lockdown period, because I did a lot of online gigs from my house, and I've continued to do those gigs actually, and I did a lot of very small scale gigs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was doing gigs on kind of online platforms where there were thousands of people, but I was also doing tiny gigs for individual households in people's back gardens, you know, and latterly in people's living rooms. And I think when you're down to that kind of tiny number of people, you've got to be really at ease sitting in those kind of cozy environments. And I think there was something really helpful about feeling really comfy in that zone when it came to storytelling online. Because I think part of what makes stuff work online, when you're not in the room together, there's two things make it work. One is spectacular technical wizardry and beautiful lighting and all the rest of it. But if you don't have that at your disposal, which most of us don't, then the other thing that works is just really up close and honest and, you know, unpretentious, as if you had someone sitting beside you in the room. Mm-hmm. Rather than trying to fill a big empty space. So I found it really helpful actually over the past few years. Like, it feels like quite a natural place for me to sit in.
Yeah. And how was the process? Because you recorded your last album, that was during lockdown, was it? Or...
Yeah, I recorded an album in early summer of 2021, so just when things were opening up again. And that's a duo album with my friend Dave Milligan called Still As You're Sleeping. Yeah, and it was an album that was born from lockdown. We live in the same village, south of Edinburgh, and we're long-term friends. You know, we've been friends for more than 20 years and we're neighbours as well. And it just became really clear that actually it was really easy to make music with people who are literally on my doorstep. You know, we could go and rehearse and... you know, I literally had to just cross the football pitch to make music. And I loved that process of making the album with Dave, because it was very stripped down. I didn't have to play anything. I was just singing for the first time. And he's an incredible pianist. Composer. So we each had our thing that we did, but we didn't get in each other's way. And it was a really lovely process. But I've been writing all through lockdown, actually, for not necessarily making an album, but writing for projects that have commissioned me to write songs. So I've got a whole bunch of new songs up my sleeve that don't really exist in any recorded form yet. So there's going to be a bunch of new songs that I'll be bringing to the gig at Colchester and all the other gigs on this tour.
Excellent stuff. And are you able to divulge what any of those projects are, or are they all kind of secret at the moment in terms of what that music might be?
Well, I think the Spell Songs project it continues to be alive. So there's plans afoot already for another round of collaboration with all my bandmates in Spell Songs. And for folks that have never heard of that project, it's inspired by the work of Robert McFarlane and Jackie Morris. It's all about nature and environment and ecology. So all the songs are inspired by plants and animals and you know, all the life that kind of grows around us. And that's a big thing for me. Like, that's a really big source of inspiration for me as a writer and a storyteller. So that'll definitely be popping up again over the next couple of years. And I've got one project I can't talk about. What I can say is it's with two of my favourite singers. And one of them is based in the UK and one of them is based in the US. And I'm really excited about that. That'll be a three-headed collaboration, and some work has already begun on that, and I'll bring some of the songs that I'm going to contribute to that collaborative process on this tour, just to kind of get them out into the world.
That's something that will get people quite excited, I think, because they'll all be trying to guess what that might be now, I think, when they hear this. So that's good. In terms of, will you be performing any of the Scottish Songbook songs? Because I know you went and recorded Well, many different songs.
Yeah, that was in 2019. So that project, the Scottish Songbook, was kind of my sort of folky interpretations of classic Scottish pop, rock and indie songs from the past 50 years. So it included songs by the likes of, I mean, it was quite heavily weighted towards the 80s because that's my era. but I had everything from sort of Jerry Rafferty and John Martin in the 70s through Deacon Blue, Big Country, Eurythmics in the 1980s, and right up to more contemporary stuff by bands like Biffy Clyro and Churches. I love that process because I love songs. Like I'm known as a folk singer, but my interest in songs is not confined to folk music. I just love good songs, whatever shape or genre they come in. And especially I love songs that tell a story. So a lot of those songs, when you strip away the production that makes them into pop songs, actually they sound a little bit like folk songs to me. Well, so I will be singing a couple of them on the tour. Yes, I'll be drawing a lot from many different kind of collaborative projects that I've done over the past, I guess, 10 years. And like I say, bringing some new stuff that hasn't really been tested out on the roads yet.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. Will the Strawberry Switchblade song be making an appearance? Or?
Oh, do you know what, mate? I love the Strawberry Switchblade song. I've sung it a few times. One of the other things I love to do is run singing workshops and kind of scratch choirs. And I've had the Strawberry Switchblade song out a few times for other folks to sing. So there's a chance, maybe some Strawberry Switchblade, maybe some Waterboys, maybe some Deacon Blue. Actually, I'm very lucky today. Today, in fact, it's really, I pinch myself whenever this kind of thing happens. But this afternoon, I'm going home to record a song for Ricky Ross from Deacon Blue, which is really fantastic. And it's lovely how some of the people who were my musical heroes when I was growing up, you know, when I was a teenager. Yeah, you know, I've just been on the phone to Ricky Ross. I think if you told my 15-year-old self that was going to happen, I would never have believed you.
And does that, I mean, would that be something that you would like to maybe do a continuation, maybe do a part two of the Scottish songs? Is there?
Yeah, lots of people have asked. And actually, I loved touring with that project. I toured with a six-piece band. It was properly joyous. And, you know, we played some absolutely beautiful venues. We had an amazing gig at the Barbican in London. We sold out the Usher Hall in Edinburgh. You know, it was really a proper joyous thing to be involved in. And, you know, around half the songs that we sang each night are not on the record. So people have asked me repeatedly since, is there going to be a Scottish Songbook part two? And maybe there will be. Maybe there will be 2 or 3 years down the line. That might be a really beautiful thing to be part of. But at the moment, I feel like I'm just easing myself very gently back into the realm of touring because it's been such a strange time. And lots of people's lives have changed in the intervening period as well. So a lot of, you know, many musicians have had to stop being musicians. So I feel very fortunate that I still get to do this because I have pals and peers who've just had to give it up because it's been too difficult. So at the moment, the simplest thing is to tour in a really kind of stripped back format and kind of truck myself around the country. So that's the plan. That's the plan this time. But I'm really looking forward to being with you. And I've heard such beautiful things about the venue. So I'm really looking forward to it. I think, in fact, am I right about this? Has there just been in the big space in Colchester, has there just been a production of Local Hero recently? I'm wondering now, it's a terrible thing, you should never admit to anybody, I get Colchester and Chichester muddled.
Well, because they're both marvellous places. I mean,
they're
both
marvellous places, so I might be like a wee bit mixing up my Chesters. So,
well, I was worrying then because I thought I was culturally not up to speed, and I thought, has there been?
I've just massively put my foot in it. It's a little bit like when you go to do a gig in Gateshead and you tell everybody, you know, it's really nice to be in Newcastle. It's like, just don't do that. So I'm really sorry. When I come to Colchester, I'll remember that I'm not in Chichester. So
well,
don't
I, I, I think you will adore the Art Centre because it is a wonderful old church, and it's got fantastic acoustics. I mean, it's got, I think they, it's got a wonderful kind of PA and lighting system and everything. And I think it's,
So I've got this horrible feeling now. This is a terrible thing. You know,
go
when
on.
like years, there's just been such a breach, and I find it now that when I meet people that I knew from a few years ago, I can't remember their names because I haven't met them for a few years. Like, it's happened quite a lot recently because you've just had that interruption. And now that you're, I'm kind of like, I totally have played in Colchester. What I'd love is if you could ask me about if you've ever played in Colchester before, and I'm going to change my answer.
We'll do that now then. So, and so if I can ask you, so have you played in Colchester before?
I have played in Colchester before, and I think the first time I played in Colchester was, gosh, it could be like 22 or 23 years ago, with a band called Malinky, a Scots-Irish band. And then I definitely came back under my own steam. And what I remember about Colchester is meeting someone that I went to primary school with in primary one, and they were in the front row of the gig, and I hadn't seen them for about 35 years. And they were there. So yes, I have been in Colchester, but it's been a long time. So I'm looking forward to coming back.
Well, and we're looking forward to having you back as well.
And thank you to Corinne Paulwart there for giving up some time to come and speak to us here at Colchester Arts Centre. And once again, if you haven't already got your ticket, they're selling out fast, so I'd be as quick as you can. And now it's that time that you've been waiting for, where Dr. Anthony Roberts, the Art Centre Director, reads a piece from one of his recently published columns, also available in the book Never Knowingly Understood, which I believe is available to purchase at Colchester Art Centre.
Hello, this is Dr. Anthony Roberts in his ongoing series, Never Knowingly Understood, as published in the Daily Gazette and the Colchester County Standard. I went to the post office to buy a stamp for a letter. Simple. What could possibly go wrong? A lot, it would seem. First obstacle was the cashier trying to sell me home insurance. No thanks. Just a stamp, please. The expression I received upon repeating this request was one of disdain mixed with pity in equal measure. The thought of expression a teenager might deliver to a parent who's just asked what makes TikTok so interesting. Contempt, utter contempt. And just when did they start selling home insurance at the post office anyway? In my world, a post office sells stamps and distributes pension money and lives in a dedicated building called the Post Office on Head Street and not tucked away at the back of WH Smith's. In my world, Marks and Spencer's just sells clothes, not fancy foods, and a company called Virgin just sells records at shops called Virgin Records. I'm told this is all about diversifying to survive. I heard the new head of Royal Mail on the radio the other day explaining that there was no profit left in letters anymore, and it was only parcels where real money was to be made. Which makes me wonder, what will happen when parcels are no longer profitable? Will Royal Mail switch to burgers and fast food? Hello, I'm here to buy some stamps. Certainly, sir. Would you like fries and home insurance with that? Eat in or take away? Talking of fast food, the most iconic and the highest profile brand of all outlets is still McDonald's. For their branding, whatever their new product, all they do is simply add the prefix of McC to everything. So, for instance, the new veggie burger is called the McPlant Burger. Genius! So, what happens when McDonald's needs to diversify? When people no longer fancy a Big Mac for their tea? Maybe they could fit their branding to apply it and apply it to all sorts of other exciting products and services. When the fast food money wagon eventually comes to a grinding halt, they could expand into other areas as far away from fast food as buying aeroplanes is from the original Virgin Records idea. The Justice and Prison Service. Now they are crying out for further privatisation, are they not? McDonald's would make a grand job of running these. Strange Ways could be rebranded very simply as McStrange Ways. And before the McJudge passed McSentence on the convicted felon, the McVictim could make a statement to the effect that the judge should abandon the 12 McLife sentences in favour of the McDeath sentence. In fact, the whole criminal justice system could be neatly streamlined in one of their drive-through facilities. You arrive at the queue, announce your crime in the speaker unit, and collect your sentence at the next available window. The newly branded McRoyal Mail could ditch not only letters, but parcels too, along with any semblance of delivering anything at all or providing any public service whatsoever. It could actually just operate as a giant hedge fund with no post offices, no post boxes, no posties, or any of that pesky non-profitable nonsense to get in the way of delivering McProfits year on year. Maybe we should just let Amazon Prime take over everything. I mean everything. Government, education, the church, the universe. Yes, the universe. It could start small, perhaps by just sending someone into space, someone high up in the company maybe. But after that, it could expand into infinity. After all, infinity's been running at a loss for what seems like eternity.
And thank you there to Dr. Anthony Roberts for that rather splendid piece. And, well, it just leaves me to say thank you very much for listening in, and I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. And if you'd like to follow us, then please do so. You can find the podcast on the podcast link at the top of the Colchester Arts Centre website. And you can listen to it on all the usual places, Spotify, etc. There's also an extended version, which is available on Mixcloud. And it's also repeated every Sunday evening at 8 o'clock on Colne Radio. And thank you very much for listening in. And we'll be back and we'll see you next time.